Hear ye, hear ye. Welcome, oh welcome indeed, to the Failing Writers Podcast, where merry folk commune on their long and burdensome voyage towards creative eminence, glory and riches.
Hello, bienvenue, and welcome to another Failing Writers Podcast. I feel like
Hello.
We should have a Steve Wright zoo clap there, shouldn't we? Like, woo, woo,
yeah, woo. That was also quite an Olympic intro as well, to match the ongoing sporting activity of the world at the minute. So,
although that's going to be out of date when this goes out, but that's...
It will be, won't it? So maybe
I don't know. It seems like they've been going on for an awful long time.
because
they keep thinking up random events.
Yeah,
that's true.
Some of the stuff that's in the Olympics is, I mean, it's brilliant, but it's kind of crazy, isn't it?
It is.
It's mad that everything isn't in.
But you find yourself watching it that you'd never watch it before. Like, I watched the entire mountain biking thing. I have no interest in mountain biking whatsoever. But then by the end of it, you start thinking you're some kind of expert.
That's right.
And going, oh, yeah, well, that's quite a big, it's a big drop, that one, isn't it?
He's lost 2 tenths there, hasn't he, with that?
Yeah, because the sideways camber, he's got the wrong tyres on, to be fair. I don't know why he's chosen that.
All experts, aren't we?
I did actually start watching the dressage. I've realised that if they want to...
you do walk a bit like that, though, so I see why you quite like that. That's how you kind of... Yeah,
he does hyperextend.
He does
the legs
very slowly, strut, but in a very measured,
tiny little steps. Yeah. No, I was thinking if they want to sort of open that out to the real people, they probably need to change the name dressage to horse dancing.
Yeah,
I was thinking
strictly horse.
You're just gonna get a more diverse audience. And rider.
Yeah, I think you're right, John. I think it is the name of the event that's stopping more ordinary people getting into.
When you say more diverse, do you mean like using different animals?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah,
because round here, you know, we do have the odd horse, but there's a lot more sheep and cows.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
Is Marjorie Graham from Rotherham? On Sally, the sheep. We could that from all the different countries. You'd have different ones, wouldn't
you? Yeah.
People turning up on antelopes and elks and...
Lions.
Yeah.
Kind of cool, wouldn't it? That'd spice it up a bit.
Yeah, that's what they should do.
Food for thought, isn't
it? Yeah, send that to the Olympic Committee. Definitely.
Send a couple of emails today.
Yeah, they're not going to turn that down, are they?
Olympics aside...
Yeah, let's just say it was an international opening. So wherever you are listening in the world, welcome.
Albeit and venue.
Yeah, or willkommen. So today we've got quite an exciting, like a hybrid episode, haven't we?
It's like half and half. You know when you go to a pizza place and you discover that they can do half and half?
Yes.
And it is one of the most exciting days of your life. It's a little bit like that.
So we've got a bit of chat coming up and then later on we've got an interview.
We have indeed. We are interviewing the excellent Chris Paling.
Who's written a book that the title of could be literally written for this podcast. It's kind of... It was a deep synergy, wasn't it, as soon as we saw about it and John got on the case and asked him if he'd come on. But yeah.
It just seemed like the obvious choice of person to interview.
Yeah, with his book, A Very Nice Rejection Letter, The Diary of a Novelist.
So that's coming up in the second half of the show. But in the first half, we have to ask the question, don't we? What have we been writing this week, chaps? I could start that by saying nothing. Absolutely nothing.
Is it just me or this week seems to have just vanished?
This week has just vanished.
I don't know where it's gone. Yeah.
I've had the best of intentions, but I haven't really found any... It's just, I haven't not done anything. It's just the week's vanished.
Yeah. Just time has gone. Although, actually, saying that, I have actually written something that I haven't written for a very long time, because we've all been doing some actual adverts, haven't we?
We have.
This week.
Yes, we've got a little job of writing the start of some little video skits, I guess you'd call
it. Yeah. Creative advertising. I never thought I would do that ever again. It's been about 15 years, I think.
Yeah, I could tell when you sent your stuff through, Dave, actually. It had a feeling of like 2 decades.
I'm just out of practice. Yeah.
I wonder if we'll get to...
Bit ring rusty.
I wonder if they'll ever air and we'll actually get to show people.
Well, if I've learned anything in my copywriting career, John, is when you do stuff at this stage of a project, it will bear very little relation to what actually comes out at some point.
Well, that is very true.
Or it'll be some weird hybrid of something. And
wait till the client gets their hands on it.
Do you remember when you used to get clients and you'd write some, you'd think, oh, I've got some brilliant ideas here. So you'd do maybe two or three different campaigns very separate, with a different angle in, a different nub, a different point of view, different characters.
I know where this
different
is going.
Things. Yeah. And they go in and go, I love this. Yeah. This is brilliant. And you think, I'm brilliant at this, mate. Oh, these are brilliant, brilliant. Hey, Denise, come and have a listen to these. They're brilliant. They're brilliant. Yeah, brilliant. So what we want, if can you take a bit of the first one and that second paragraph, we like that in the second one, and then the bit with the other character, can you put those in the other one? And you just be sat there with your heart would just sink and you think, it's not
yeah.
even.
Oh, God.
Not even possible, really.
Because you know you'll go away and have a go at trying to do that.
I think that's often the problem, you know? That you kind of went away and did it, and then with the audio producer managed to actually get something that sounded decent, and you'd just be making a rod for your own back because they go, yeah, you see, that sounds good. You said it couldn't be done. Look.
Yeah, but deep down you'd know it's just garbage. Yeah.
Client's always right, eh?
Well, as long as we get paid for it. Hey, that's the main thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's been quite, it's been quite good fun, I suppose, trying to get back into the mindset of creative writing. It's good to have something that's quite short and over with quite quickly and actually have a deadline for something, innit? You know what I mean? It's,
that's very
it's writing something that you know somebody's going to read quite soon and give you a decision on it straight away. So that's...
Yeah, and pay you anyway.
Yeah, that would be...
So in many ways, completely the opposite of the stuff we've been writing
for ourselves.
Exact
opposite.
Yeah.
Makes me wonder why I got out of it in the first place, I suppose.
So Dave, in these short 15-second little skits that we've been doing for the aforementioned client project, did you find that you were able to structure them better? Because you are about to give us a review of a book.
Yeah, I tried to implement the tools in this 200-page book into those 15-second adverts as much as I could. No, I didn't. But we probably should hark back to, this is a book that you set me to read ages ago now.
We did.
Well, there was a weird week, wasn't there, where John just got suddenly really aggressive about giving people books to read.
Yeah, yeah.
He had a proper like chip on his shoulder about making other people read books.
Yeah, and after that, he's the only one who hasn't done it yet.
I have read it, though. I just haven't talked about it.
Fair enough.
What's the book called, David?
The book is called The Hidden Tools of Comedy by Steve Kaplan. He's been a consultant for DreamWorks and Disney and HBO and Aardman, and he's been doing these
But apart from that, what's he done, though, Dave?
Exactly. Hey? What has he done
How can
recently?
We know he knows what he's on about?
But apparently he's been doing these workshops for years and years and years. He's like quite a well-respected man in LA, and someone told him he should write a book of that, so he has. And I've read it, and I will reveal its contents to you now.
Can I just ask, Dave, have you done any work on your ability to give marks out of 10 since last week? Because that was...
I've left that to the end.
Right.
I'll try and give it a score out of 10 at the end.
Yeah. And then we'll have a better idea as well of whether that kind of matches with what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Okay.
But the review is, it was good.
Okay, I'm getting...
How did you like it?
Did you like it? I liked it a lot. No, it was really...
I'm getting 7 or above then. Sorry, we're not there yet. Carry on.
6.5. No, it was really good. Because it's not so much... Because there's a lot of books and things out there like about how to be funny, which I often don't think work very well. Because I do think it's pretty difficult to teach someone to be funny if you're just not.
Yeah, yeah.
But this isn't so much about like how to be funny. It's more about how to fix a scene or a story or something that's not quite working.
Right, okay.
So it's about sort of recognizing the things that get in the way of your comedy.
That's good.
Yeah. So it's
assuming that you are funny and can write funny.
Yes.
In the first place.
Exactly.
Otherwise, presumably, you wouldn't be doing it.
Exactly. You've kind of got to have written something to begin with.
And this helps you make it funnier.
Yes, it's kind of much about what to leave out as it is about what to put in. And it's great because it uses, like, as you're reading it, you get a real sort of sense of what it would be like to be in one of the workshops, because he puts in the examples of clips that he would play in the workshops, and there's things from like Mel Brooks and Seinfeld and Groundhog Day, and some other examples from movies where things don't work so well, and then, you know, actually talks you through why that works and why it doesn't. And one of the sort of really good examples is he talks about, apparently there's a like an early draft script of Groundhog Day somewhere online that you can read. And it's absolutely full of gags. Like every other line is a joke, pretty much. And he said that, like, you can sort of, you can trace where it begins to work better as they start to take gags out. And one of the reasons for this is it's kind of all about character. So you've got this, everyone's seen Groundhog Day, this guy wakes up and he's in the same place as he was yesterday, and he's trapped in this sort of perpetual day. And if you imagine yourself in that sort of scenario, the last thing you would probably do is try to be funny, you know, start to make little quips and gags every time someone says something. You'd be absolutely desperate to get out. And it's when they start to follow that path of being true to the character that everything else had room to be funny.
Yeah.
And it makes an awful lot of sense.
It does.
I think the main lesson of the book is, like, don't try to be funny. Just, like, set your characters up properly and set the situation properly, and the comedy should just sort of happen, really.
Yeah, because actually Groundhog Day is quite a good example of that then. If it had gags in previously, as the days go on and on and on, it becomes more and more sardonic, doesn't he, and kind of depressed about the whole thing, and the humour comes out of that, and his sarcasm, and it's heavy kind of,
and then it gets quite black, doesn't it?
Cheap little gags.
Yeah, exactly. And he uses, Steve Kaplan has this sort of, he calls it a comedy equation. There aren't any numbers in it, which is probably a good thing. And what he sort of, and this is kind of, it's specifically for like screenplays and movies really, but it kind of works in anything. And what he says is that comedy is about an ordinary person struggling against insurmountable odds without many of the required skills and tools with which to win, yet never giving up hope. And if you think about it, that kind of describes all the sort of the best comedy characters. But if you take any of those elements out at any point, it sort of stops being funny. So you think about Basil Fawlty in Fawlty Towers. He has this dream of like the perfect upmarket hotel, but he doesn't have any of the skills required to achieve that. He's not a people person. He hasn't got any money. He hasn't got sort of breeding, anything like that. But he never gives up hope. He's constantly trying to achieve the impossible, and that's why it sort of keeps being funny. Like if he loses hope at any point, if he just falls into despair, it stops being funny, and it becomes a tragedy.
Yeah.
And another example I thought of the other day is, like, the last series of Only Fools and Horses, where they suddenly become millionaires after trying to be that. It just instantly stops being funny.
I think that was a way of shutting it down, though, wasn't
it? Yeah, exactly.
And that's exactly why.
Yeah. Well,
that was a way of going, right, this is done now. Finished. It's done.
Can never be funny again.
Done. You can't make us do any more Christmas specials.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a really good, really sort of inspirational book. And I, as I was sort of going through it, I kept thinking, do you know what? I could apply that to some things that I've written. And I guess the best sort of review of it is that once I'd finished reading it, I instantly wanted to start writing another series of Anything For You.
Ooh.
So that's going to be my next project, is to try and write another series of that, but use these tools to see if I can make it better.
I'd say that was a very good review, that it actually inspires you to want to keep writing. That's all you want, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, it absolutely does. It sort of...
What was it like, Dave, in terms of how prescriptive was it? Or how did it just kind of... Did you feel like it was just giving you the tools? Obviously, it inspired.
Yeah, I think it's very good in that sense, because it, all the way through, he kind of keeps reminding you, this isn't... It's not like a... it's not an instruction manual. It's not like how to write something funny or how to be funny. These are tools to use... when something isn't working, or to make something as good as it can possibly be, but it doesn't at any point say do this, and do this, and you will have something funny. So in that sense, I just found it, I found it really good.
Is it funny to read, or is it like like weirdly dry?
That's a good question, that, because so often the people that write funny aren't that funny.
Yeah, it's...
Do you mean they've almost been bred out where they are capable of seeing something really funny, and their response, rather than laughter, is inevitably go, that works.
Yeah.
But they might... Yeah, but in a way, like, comedy is a serious business, isn't it? Like, if you know the ins and outs of it, you're not really trying to... Anyway, we should probably just ask Dave whether it is funny or not.
I mean, I suppose we could while he's here.
It would make sense, I suppose. Or just guess. What do you think? No,
I think it's not that funny to read.
I think it's probably got elements of humour in it.
I think it's clear from the writing that he's a funny guy, but he's not. Again, he's not trying to be funny in it. You know, he's just sort of making a point, and then handing over to a clip. So there's like some sections from something about Mary, just kind of showing here's an example of where it does work, and here's an example of like where it doesn't work. So yeah, it's not like a laugh out loud.
It's quite interesting, isn't it, that he's able to pick out examples of major massive feature films where there's something that obviously doesn't work in it.
Yeah, and it's quite.
Do you know, when you think how much revision and how many script editors and how many people and writers and stuff and directors have been involved in the whole thing, that at some point someone's not gone, that doesn't quite work.
Yeah, that is quite actually quite brutal about one movie in particular. I'm trying to find it. He sort of really hammers into it for a good while and keeps sort of, every time he mentions something that doesn't work, he harks back to this one particular movie.
Do you get the feeling he didn't like the person who wrote it?
Quite possibly, some sort of beef with the guy who did it. But again, he's not sort of really prescriptive about saying, oh, you should find this funny or you should find that funny. Mm. He's just sort of saying, look, this works. Like this sort of objectively works. And like comedy itself is very subjective, isn't it? You know, if I think he kind of says right at the start, if somebody does something and you laugh, then it's funny. You can't argue whether it's funny or not. It just, if you laugh, it's funny. But it's about taking that and making a better piece, you know, a better movie or a better sitcom or a better whatever.
Is he's not specifically talking about movie screenplays. Is he talking about series? He's talking about books? A bit of everything?
I think it's kind of about character and story, really.
Which obviously applies to anything.
Yes, yeah. He sort of uses more sort of movie examples. I think that's kind of where most of it comes from. But then again, he does use a lot of Seinfeld as well. But it's all sort of, you know, sort of staples of story and staples of character, which you could apply to anything, really.
And do you think there's a cultural, are there any cultural differences between the US and the UK? Or did it feel like that is probably bang on in the UK as well?
Yeah, he does. I think there's actually a bit where he talks about the difference between sort of British comedy and American comedy. But he also uses, like, you know, like I said, Fawlty Towers as an example.
Oh, right, he uses that example.
Yeah, I think it's just, they're pretty much just kind of universal rules. Oh, yeah, he talks about, like, somebody was saying the other day, weren't they, about how, like, in America, the culture is much more about winning and, you know, sort of supporting, you know, being behind the guy who's going to win, whereas in this country, we're much more sort of for the underdog.
And we're happy to see them fail.
Yes, yeah. But what he's kind of saying is that the sort of the key of, like, comedy is that the person has to keep trying. They have to have hope that they're going to win all the time. Even though they don't have the skills required to actually succeed, they have to sort of keep on trying.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's like I said, we enjoy kind of the humour of watching them fail.
Yeah.
And not have the tools, as long as they come back in the next episode and try again.
Yeah.
You know, Del Boy is a brilliant example of that, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, Del Boy's a great example of summing up the sort of, you know, the character goals in a catchphrase, isn't it? When you know, this time next year we'll be millionaires. That's the whole thing that drives him all the way through. So we can never achieve that, but he's got to keep going for it.
Have you noticed there's a parallel between that and this podcast?
how we keep striving to make a good episode.
Having the hope, but not having the skills.
That's true. Oh, dear. What makes this perfect... Perfect comedy.
That's why it's funny.
Yeah, exactly.
We have to keep failing, otherwise we're really
funny. That should be our excuse.
Ever win.
So, Dave, we get to a moment now where you can show how much you've learned since last week.
Yeah.
What would you give it in terms of marks out of 10?
I think I would give it an 8.5.
Whoa.
Okay. Between 8.5 and 9.
That is a
8.75 is that's mathematically where you're going there then.
But I'm not gonna say what out.
Right, okay. Well, one step at a time. That's good. Yeah. That's a good step.
8.75.
Next week I'll tell you what the score was out of. Yeah.
That is solid. Yeah. Wow, that's a must read.
Well, I think we should all
it was really good. And actually I've just found the example of a really terrible movie that he mentions. It's called Alex and Emma. Have you ever heard of a movie called Alex and Emma?
No, never heard of it. It might be a reason why.
There you go. Luke Wilson and Kate Hudson. Mm. So, you know, it's quite a big movie, I think. But, yeah, it's an example of getting it wrong.
Rom-com?
I think it's a rom-com sort of thing, yeah.
So what do you think? What do you think Alex and Emma got as its average score on Rotten Tomatoes? Its percentage score?
A 37.
Yeah, I was going to go low.
11.
There.
11? Wow.
11%. So wow. He was probably right to use that
as
a...
was right, wasn't he?
Yeah. Critics' consensus... a dull and unfunny comedy, an unfunny comedy, that's like the worst slight ever, isn't it? That's brilliant. A dull and unfunny comedy where the leads fail to generate any sparks.
Wow.
Not really what you want from a rom-com, that is it really? It's not ticked a lot of the boxes. Yeah, there's no chemistry and no jokes.
But yeah, just to sort of carry that in, what he said about it is that all the way through, you could tell the writers were going, so, wouldn't it be funny if they did this here, rather than... it being something like, well, okay, what would that character do in this situation?
Mm. Do you think that might be an example of a film that would be very hard to write a log line for? Like, you can't see the jokes. What is the idea of the film? What would the log line be, Dave?
Probably, yeah.
Come on, you've seen the film.
Well, writer Alex Sheldon must finish his novel within a month. If he doesn't, he won't get paid. And if that happens, angry mafia types to whom he owes money will come looking for him. Huh?
That's it. Oh. Yeah, that's
so right. He hires typist, wow, Emma Dinsmore, played by Kate Hudson, begins dictating his novel. So that's the idea. But as Alex falls for Emma, his work takes a different turn. And hilarity doesn't ensue.
There we go.
Thank you, David.
You're very welcome.
Great
Jonathan
review, Dave.
And
very
Thomas. Good. So, John, what? Remind us, what is the book that you've read and are yet to review for a future episode?
It was Blake Snyder's Save the Cat.
Oh, yes.
Which is, yeah, it's a massive one, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah, all right, well.
And it is really good.
Don't give it away. Don't say now whether it's good or not. Save it for the review.
Okay. No, I think I've already said it in another episode. In fact, I think I talked about it quite a lot. Having said that, I won't talk about it now. I'll save it for another episode. I think I basically went through it. No, I'll go through it in a bit more detail because I think it's worth it. I think it's very good.
Yeah.
Any last little tools of comedy, Dave, that you picked up? Any other little tips? Give us one more tool before you... close the book.
Hang on, let me just have a little look here. This thing he calls the straight line or the wavy line, which is basically a sort of breakdown or a little change on the old idea of the straight man and the funny man. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people have this idea that, you know, there should be a funny person who's supposed to be saying the funny lines and a straight person is supposed to be saying the straight lines. And what he's saying is that it doesn't have to be that prescriptive. Because, mm-hmm, you know, you get a lot of actors who always want to have the sort of funny lines in movies, and sometimes, like, to the detriment of the film, because it shouldn't be that character who says that line to make it funny.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So he was saying it's not about a straight person, a funny person. You can use this straight line, wavy line. So as long as there's one sort of straight line and one wavy line in any particular moment, it'll work.
So it's more about the content than the... character delivery.
Yes, because he says...
Or in Alex and Emma, just don't have any funny lines.
Just don't have either, yeah. But what he sort of says is that comedy comes from... there's a good quote in there from John Cleese about when they first started writing Monty Python, they thought comedy was about, like, people doing silly things. But as they sort of went on, they realised comedy's about people seeing other people doing silly things. So the comedy doesn't come from somebody doing something. The comedy often comes from another person who's there seeing it and their reaction to that.
Oh, that shines through Monty Python, doesn't it? Straight away, as soon as you've said that.
Exactly, yeah. So, you know, there's always got to be somebody there.
So kind of the straight man.
Yeah, but that can change.
It's just a reaction.
Yeah,
right?
It can change through the course of a scene or what have you. Or, you know, if you think of a movie like The Naked Gun, where somebody says something that's totally wacky, there's always somebody else there giving them a look.
To give a glance to camera
And it's that's where the sort of the comedy comes from, is not seeing someone do something silly, but seeing somebody else react to somebody else doing something silly.
Which then makes you, as part of the audience, part of that reaction.
Yeah.
So you're
sort of in on it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So there we go.
Yeah, it's good.
My little hidden tool of the day.
Good. I like it.
Yeah, well done for reading
that. Sounds like you might have got something out of it as well.
I really did. I felt proper inspired by it. So I finished the book and I was like, right, this is what I'm going to do now. And by the end of the day, I'd sort of planned out.
By the end of the day, he'd made 4 cups of tea. He'd mown the lawn. And
it wasn't even my lawn. I planned out the sort of basic storyline for the next series.
Oh, wow.
What the sort of overarching story.
Yes. Yeah. So what's going to happen to the characters in general. So, yeah, that's my...
Brilliant.
Very inspirational.
Brilliant.
Well done, Dave. Hey, maybe we should read some more books.
I'd say now look what we've done, Dave. Now look what we've done. John's going to start barking out random books again.
3 more coming up.
Yep. You read the Bible. You read War and Peace.
And can I read The Big Red Tractor? A little bit shorter. It goes up to the field. And then I believe it comes back again.
But obviously not all books can be successful all the time.
Oh, I can feel a seamless link coming on, Dave.
Not everything that you write is going to be well received.
Really?
So sometimes...
I suppose at some point you might get rejection letters.
You might do. If only someone was about to talk to us about that particular subject.
Oh, wait a minute.
What?
Who's this on the line?
I don't know. What's his name, John?
His name is Chris Paling, a writer whose new book, A Very Nice Rejection Letter, Diary of a Novelist, has just been released. He's with us now. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Chris.
Hello. Good to meet you all.
Hello.
We're very excited to have you on.
You don't get many self-confessed failing writers on the Failing Writers podcast.
No.
I've been looking at your back catalogue, and most of them seem to be fairly successful. So.
They are, but we should point out, though, Chris, we are the Failing Writers. You're not the Failing Writer. You haven't been invited on as a failing writer. I hope you get that.
That's a shame.
From our point of view... You've had a stratospheric career.
Exactly.
I mean, you've had actual books published.
Yeah.
You know, and people have written nice things about you and cared about your books. So we just need to make that clear early on. You know, there are levels of failure, aren't there?
I'm interested to note that you're a failing writers podcast rather than a failed writers podcast, which kind of suggests it's a work in progress rather than the work
finished.
We will
get there, though. We will one day become failed writers.
Yes.
Yeah. Pretty sure. Yeah.
Something to strive for, yeah.
There are 3 little letters that have a huge effect. 3 little letters that you must respect. 3 little letters that mean the world to me. They are ING. You're not a sailor till you go sailing. It isn't nailed on if you're still nailing. You're not a failure if you're Chris Paling. Ing is the operative word. You can't be overlooked if you're still looking. It isn't overcooked if you're still cooking. You're pretty much off the hook if you're still fishing. Ing is the operative. Let's get cooperative. Ing is the operative word. That was the original reason for the podcast, is that we could try and shame each other into writing more and go on our little journey together.
And so has it worked? I mean...
Well, it's early days. Let's just put it that way. It's early days.
Yeah. Again, yeah, let's stick with the ING suffix. It's working.
Yeah. Yes. It's working. Good.
Yeah.
So... Maybe we could start, if you don't mind, Chris, if you could give us your description of the book.
Okay. Around 2006, 2007, I started keeping a journal when I got, I got a few novels out then, but I just started keeping a journal just for my own entertainment, really. And then I put it aside and I didn't look at it for years and years. I kept it for a couple of years. And then I had a bout of ill health a few years ago. And I kept another journal there because I quite liked the journal form. And then more recently, I started another journal after I wrote my last book, which was about the local library where I work.
Oh, yeah. Reading aloud.
And that was another sort of journal. And then I was talking to the agent and he said, have you got anything on the stocks? Because we obviously can't flog this novel you're trying to pout around. And I said, not really. I just got this old journal rubbish. Do you want to have a look at it? And he looked at it and he said, I think we can do some of this. And the weird thing was that the latter part of the journal becomes about the publication of the book about
what I
failure.
Really enjoyed about it, particularly sort of towards the start, was the fact you could tell, obviously, it had been written as a journal. And it's very kind of transient, isn't it, writing like that? Because you're not expecting it to be kept or go anywhere, really, and it's kind of for your eyes. And there was a lovely, genuine honesty undercurrent in it. Did you go back and tweak things, or was it kind of true to itself?
No, it is true to itself. I thought I was
very
really
much felt like that, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't want to go back and rewrite myself as the, you know, the hero of my own story. It was supposed to be honest, because I remember when I first wrote it, I never showed it to my agent then, who was somebody called Deborah Rogers, who was this kind of legendary figure. She was brilliant. But I showed it to her assistant. I said, look, just have a look at this. I don't think she was very happy with it. She said, Deborah works very hard for you, you know. And I said, I know she does. And I suddenly realised that maybe this whole journal was about how terrible my agent was. And it's not. It's just about kind of relationships between agents and writers and publishers, and everybody's trying their best, and sometimes it comes off and sometimes it doesn't. But I think maybe she picked up on the honesty.
It's
of
very
it,
naked, really. Actually, isn't it?
Yeah.
I just going back to when you were younger, Chris, that there was one particularly heartbreaking bit in the book, which was the time you wrote a sort of, I think it was a Thomas Hardy parody at school, and showed it to your English teacher, and it wasn't really received with a great deal of enthusiasm. In fact, I think you ended up almost like apologising to your English teacher for writing it. I mean, I just thought that was awful, and I'm kind of amazed. I think maybe your generation are a bit more resilient than our generation, but I think that might have just I might have just given up. And not bothered writing anymore.
I did give up after that for about a decade.
Oh, wow.
But that was the kind of school I went to. They wanted to put you in certain boxes. And I had, before that, written the start of a novel when I was a kid, when I was about 14. And I thought, blimey, this isn't too bad. I might be able to do this. And I got really excited.
Yeah. Oh, that was the street artist. The pavement artist, yeah.
But it's not, you know, I found it the other day and it's not too bad. So I wrote this thing and I wrote about 20 pages in the back of my English book. And I really literally was called to stand at her desk. And she said, well, what is this? And I said, well, it's a sort of... Yeah, it's a parody of Tests of the D'Urbervilles, which we were studying, and I don't know if there's any validity in it, but I literally had to apologise. You know, what's this about? And why are you doing it? And don't make sure you don't do it again, really. And so I didn't, you know, 10, 15 years, didn't really write again.
Who did they want you to apologise to? The teacher, the class? The
Thomas?
Thomas, yeah, the history of literature? Or...
Yeah, everything, everywhere. I had to apologise to her for wasting paper in the back of her valuable English book.
Bloody hell.
Or if you're an English teacher, you'd be so delighted, wouldn't you, if someone was inspired enough to write, even if it was a parody or even if it was a bit jokey, you'd just be thrilled, wouldn't you?
Well, you would nowadays kind of hope so, wouldn't you? But in that school, everything was kind of frowned down upon. It was an appalling place. I had a miserable time for 7 years, but let's not talk about myself.
Let's move on. So what got you back into writing then, after that pretty bad start?
Well, I didn't do any after that for about 10 years. And then I suppose in my mid-20s, I was working for the BBC as a sound engineer, studio manager. I worked across quite a lot of output. I worked for Radio 4, did a bit of sport, worked a bit on Radio 1, but I worked weird shifts. Mm. And one afternoon, I was sitting at home in Brighton in the middle of the afternoon and just sat down and wrote a story. I don't know why. And I thought it was okay. And I sent it off to this guy called Mitch Raper, who used to edit this thing called Morning Story on Radio 4. And he was a brilliant old boy, really. I mean, he was incredibly productive. Yeah. He used to produce at least 4 stories a week, virtually every week of the year. And he got the scripts to the studio, he booked the actors, he edited the thing, and he did all the continuity details and got it on air. Anyway, on top of all of that, he always responded to every story that was sent to him, even if it was complete rubbish. And he rejected the stories I sent, but in such a way that he suggested that I had some talent. And I think it was those letters I got back from dear old Mitch that I thought, okay, maybe I can do it. So I just kept writing, really, and the stories led to a 30-minute theatre, which I wrote, and that was commissioned and performed. And then it kind of all started from there, really. I mean, my radio drama career was fairly short, so I gave that up, and then I wrote a novel, and then that was sold, and the writing career really started.
Well, I was going to say that, like, rejection is a massive part of being a writer, isn't it? But there are nice ways of doing it and not so nice ways of doing it. So is it fair to say that the sort of the manner of those sort of rejections that you got encourage you to keep going?
I don't know, to be quite honest. I got to the point where I thought I could write, but in other people's opinions, I couldn't. Or I couldn't write what it was that they wanted. And to be quite honest, I don't think any of those rejections actually put me off, because I just got so used to receiving them that I just thought, oh yeah, here's another rejection. It would have been a bit of a shock had any of those stories or plays been accepted. but I didn't really feel they knocked me back, to be quite honest.
Yeah.
None of them were ever very constructive. I think there's probably a way of rejecting people like Mitch did that doesn't completely destroy their confidence.
Yes.
But I think the problem with, you know, when people are pitching novels, stories, plays, whatever, I think the important thing to know when you get a rejection is not necessarily to think it's a bad piece of work. It's just a piece of work that doesn't fit the very narrow definition of what the person you're pitching it to wants.
Yes, at that time.
Yeah, at that time, yeah.
That's
And that's the strange thing about getting published. Somehow what you've written has hit the zeitgeist in such a way, or hit an editor's brain in such a way that he goes, well, I couldn't have envisaged this story coming in, but I like it enough to know it will fit my catalogue. And we might be able to sell a few copies. You know, it doesn't mean it's any better or worse than the one he's just rejected. It just fits that moment for him, you know.
It sounds like, and I think in the book you talk about it a little bit, but you kind of talk about writing more as a compulsion than a desire. Like, you have to write. Like, you never really had a choice about whether you're going to be a writer or not.
Probably something you three feel in yourselves, because... You know, the fact that you are continuing to write, there is a compulsion there. And once you get it, it is a strange sort of addiction. You can't not do it. It's very strange. Yeah. I don't know what it is.
I always find it's really hard as well to describe to people that don't have it how not fun and thoroughly unpleasant writing can be.
Yeah.
And, but they go, well, if you think that, why are you doing it then? And it's actually very hard to get any way past that, because that is actually a really good point. It's not always fun. A lot of it is hard work and slightly unpleasant.
Yeah. I mean, writing isn't that fun most of the time. I think I say in the book, you know, 90% of the time it's really hard. It's not. I think that the joy is having written. It's not writing. There's a lot of joy for me in rewriting. And I think a lot of people who are starting out work too hard at the first draft and go back and back and back. I think the point is just to splurge it on the page, just get it out there and then rewrite, because writing really is refining those first thoughts. It's like Hemingway's quote, you know, the first draft of anything is shit. And that's absolutely true, because it is. And so you've got to get over that self-criticism. I think a lot of creative writing courses teach people to refine and refine and refine, but don't refine. Finish it and then go back over it, you know?
That's an interesting point we've come across a lot in the last few weeks, really, isn't it? It's just to get something down there, then you can play around with it. But don't stress too much about the first draft.
No, absolutely not. No, do not stress beyond that, no.
So, Chris, you were obviously you're working as a BBC producer. When did you find the time to write? Because that's one of the things that we find incredibly difficult is, just grabbing at moments to actually go and do it and finding that you need a decent chunk of time.
Yeah, I don't know whether a decent chunk, you need a chunk of time. I used to write, because I live in Brighton and I worked in London, I used to commute on the train every day, and I used to write on the train, basically. I wrote the first seven novels on the train. So I wrote on the way up in the morning, and then I edited on the way back at night. So that's where I wrote the first seven novels. So I had a clear hour in the morning going up and an hour coming back.
And they're all set on trains. they're all about people on trains.
Yeah. In fact, the first one is partly set on a train. But I think that you don't need a massive chunk of time. You just need a regular chunk of time, even if it's only half an hour a day. As long as it's regular, you don't need
several hours, because when I packed up the commuting, I thought, this is what I always wanted to do. I wanted to write,
you know, full time. Absolutely hopeless. I couldn't do it. I just, there was no pressure on that time. So I just ended up looking out the window, you know, and I couldn't write. So for me, I always needed a pressure on my writing time to write anything.
Interesting.
So what did you do to overcome that?
When I packed in the community.
Did you have to find something else to sort of fill your time, to distract you from writing?
Yeah, because when I packed in the commuting, I then did a bit of writing at night, but then I packed in the Beeb, which is what led me to working in the library as a sort of casual library officer. And that's when I started keeping the journals, which led to the last non-fiction book. So the end of commuting really was the end of the novel writing.
And how did that feel? Did you feel any way about that when you'd been sort of working away on these novels, and some success with some of them and some of them perhaps didn't go where you wanted them to then to someone to read like a journal that you've sort of casually been keeping and say, oh, we can do something with this. Did that make you feel any way about, you know, the sort of time that you spent on other stuff?
Not really, because I honestly don't think any time writing anything is wasted. Everything you write leads you to the next thing you write. So even though it might not be published, I wouldn't have written my third novel without writing the second, and I wouldn't have written Reading Aloud without writing this writer's journal in 2003. So one way or another, they're all stepping stones. Every project is a stepping stone to the next one.
You've had very complimentary reviews for your books. I think you were called the literary stealth bomber, weren't you, at one point? as in nobody had heard of you, but your writing was excellent. I mean, you're clearly considered very good by critics. But what do you think has stopped you really breaking through? What's the kind of key factor in your opinion?
I think I never really particularly wrote in a single genre or a single type of book because I just got bored. So every novel I've written has been completely different from the one before. So, you know, it's the absolute death to building up a readership, to be quite honest.
Yeah. And I think it's very hard to sell.
It's really hard
to
sell. So therefore, if somebody reads, you know, I don't know, Minding or something, which is about a relationship between a woman who's losing control of her son. And then the next one I wrote was Nimrod's Shadow, which was a sort of partly historical novel about a painter. There's no connection between the two options. So for a publicist, they're impossible to sell because none of them did sell. You can't go to a bookshop and say, you know, and say, look, he did 50,000 on the last one, so stock it. They won't, you know. So I think that was part of the problem. I think at the beginning, the problem was that I was writing too much. And I think the latter problem is that I just wasn't always writing the same stuff, really. Maybe that is the answer to the question, I think.
I think you're probably right. You just need to make it very easy to sell to people.
What have the sales been looking like for the rejection, very nice rejection letter?
Oh, terrible, I think. Yeah.
Really?
I don't know. It's not selling. You know, it's you kind of watch the Amazon rankings and it hovers around sort of 30 or 40,000, which means it's done very few copies.
Yeah.
They think it might be a kind of word of mouth slow seller. So I'm kind of holding on to that one.
It does have a slight element of a good Christmas present type book to it, I think.
Can I use that on the cover of the paperback? There's a slight
absolutely. If you don't think it's too strong of an endorsement, if you think it,
I think it's about the best endorsement I've ever had. So I might use that word for word on the paperback.
Well, obviously, other than being on this podcast, other than like right now, what are the sort of moments in your career, if there've been any, when you've genuinely thought, this is it, I've absolutely made it, this is the thing that's going to accelerate me to superstardom, bosh, here we go? Have there been any sort of moments like that?
No, not really. I think, the fourth or fifth novel I wrote called Newton Swing. That one didn't do too badly, and there was a moment there where I thought, actually, that might do it, but unfortunately it didn't. And then I got this thing, got shortlisted for Mind Book of the Year and things like that. There have always been little glimmers, but I don't think there's ever been that really big moment where I thought, this is it, it's going to happen, because I don't really think it is, but I'm happy, you know, it's... It does what it needs to do, and I still write, you know, and you're talking to me, so you found validity.
Yeah, well, that was going to be my other question, because talking as sort of failing writers, the question about, like, how you actually define success as a writer. So for some people, it will be making a lot of money. For some people, it will be winning prizes. But for yourself, how would you define being successful?
Being able to continue to write and people wanting to buy that writing. People wanting to hear what you've got to say, really. That's the definition of success. It doesn't have to be 10 million people, even if it's only 10 people who want to hear it. I think that's the mark of success, really. I know I'm never going to be a huge seller, but I feel really privileged that people are still publishing what I've got, what I've got to write. For me, that's success, you know, because I know a lot of people write and they don't get published, they still write, so there's no point, you know. I don't want to whinge about not selling, because I know I'm in a very privileged position.
And I think, I certainly write not because I ever think I'm going to make it, but I write for probably the same sorts of reasons, because, you know, that compulsion to write is strong enough. But I do enjoy doing it. You know, I actually do enjoy the process. I find it very cathartic. You know, just trying out different possibilities. I do find it endlessly fascinating. That you've got these characters doing things and you can make them do anything. I suppose it's a bit like a bit of a sort of God syndrome, probably.
Yeah. I mean, it's great when you create a character and they take on a life of their own, and then they lead you rather than you leading them. That's the real joy of writing, I think. You know, they've got a life and you just follow them along the page. Yeah.
It sounds like from how you write in the book, that you're very much a discovery writer. You're not really ever writing out a clear plan of what you're about to do.
You just
kind of start writing, or do you hear the characters? Some people hear characters talking, don't they? And then they go.
It's strange, but all of the novels start with, it kind of invades all of the senses. Sometimes it's like a smell or a taste of a place. It's never a line of dialogue. And it's very rarely an image of anything or anyone. It's normally you get this taste of something. When I was writing the Nimrod Shadow that was set sort of in Edwardian London, and got this real taste of this coal dust on the palette, and then these figures kind of emerged from the mist, and then I kind of followed them, and then this other character appeared in a contemporary storyline. I don't know where she came from. So it's quite a good description, discovery writer. Usually about a third or halfway through, I get an idea of where it's got to end, because otherwise they just go on forever and they just meander. but I don't at the beginning ever know where it's going to end. So, you just go with them, really, I think.
I was just going to say, to sort of the sort of inverse of the question I asked before about were there any sort of made it moments, have you had any like utter I give up moments where you've just reached a point in a book where you've just gone, do you know what, sod it. I just can't do this anymore. I'm not doing it to myself anymore.
Oh, yeah, loads. Yeah, I've got four or five abandoned novels, definitely. Yeah, I wrote a follow-up to... I wrote a book about the BBC called Silent Century, about a jaded BBC producer, and I started writing a follow-up to that called Human Resources. And I wrote a lot of that. I wrote about 180 pages, and I just gave up, really. I just thought, what's the point? This is just a repetition. So I junked that, and then I also junked the one that followed it. So it's probably four or five almost finished novels that I've junked for whatever reason, really. There's loads around, loads of
But then there's always been something else that sort of made you go, oh, but this, now I've had this idea, I've got to write this one.
Yeah, I don't normally just chuck something away without having something. When I wrote the first novel that was sold after the raid, I was writing that in parallel with another novel, and the agent said, no, this is this other novel. I sent it to her and she said, no, we can't sell this. Get rid of it. But alongside that, I was writing After the Raid. I'd written about 60 pages, and I went back to that and I wrote that and finished it, and that's the one she sold. So it was almost like the other novel was scaffolding and it needed to be just taken away and chucked away for the other one to work. It was very hard.
Yeah.
But as I said before, nothing's ever really wasted. Everything leads to something else if you write it.
But what's the next thing for you?
The next thing is I've just rewritten a novel that I wrote years ago, and we're trying to flog that. I've got another novel as well. So there's two novels on the stocks that we're trying to sell.
Have they been written recently? One sounds like it was an old one, but is the other one more recent?
Yeah, the old one was kind of based on a film script that we were trying to sell that I turned into a novel, and then a few weeks ago reread it. And I thought, actually, this isn't too bad, so I rewrote that. I've got a novel I've been writing over the last year or so, which is finished. But I don't know, I quite enjoy nonfiction, but it's a question of coming up with the right idea that needs to be done. I don't want to just write another book about, going down the canal and being wry about Northern England or something. Like, it's got to have a purpose, really.
Yeah. So presumably you're not commuting at the moment, so are you writing just whenever you feel like it?
Yeah, I write at home now. I don't go up to London anymore. I work at the library a bit, do a bit of painting. So I tend to write.
Oh, yeah, your
in
painting,
the mornings,
your paintings
really.
Are very good. I had a look at them.
I'm probably spending more time doing that than writing at the moment. But I only tend to do one or the other. But I will. Yeah, we'll get back to the writing. I have got one idea, but I'm not sure about it yet. It's kind of brewing.
We look forward to it, whatever it may be.
Thanks. Well, it's been very good to talk to you.
Yeah, you too, Chris.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
It's been
great. Thanks for coming on.
And good luck with the book.
Thanks. You will mention it at some point, won't you?
We'll give it. As soon as we got you off the interview, we're going to give it a massive plug. We'll make an advert for it and everything. Yeah.
Brilliant.
Thanks a lot, Chris.
Thanks
really
so much,
appreciate
Chris.
It.
Take care.
Yeah, thanks. Cheers then.
Bye.
All right, Bob.
All right, Terry.
What's up, mate? You look well stressed.
Oh, it's just, Christmas is coming and. Well, we've bought so much junk online during lockdown, I can't think of what else to get for the wife.
Oh, you should get one of these, mate.
Oh, what's that?
It's a book called A Very Nice Rejection Letter by Chris Paling. It's relatively inexpensive, got some lovely words in it, and, well, it fits perfectly in a stocking.
Unlike the wife, eh?
Grab your copy of the book. Some readers are saying does have a slight element of a good Christmas present type book. Available at all good bookshops. But probably cheaper at that online place lefties say you should feel guilty about buying from.
All right, Bob, how did the wife like the book?
Really good.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah?
No, in fact, she liked it so much, she wrote me a rejection letter on Boxing Day.
Oh.
Right. Yeah, I know.
Sorry, I don't really know what to say.
Happy New Year.
A Very Nice Rejection Letter. Diary of a Novelist by Chris Paling. Available now.
So there you go. I think that does the job, doesn't it? That's an advert, as promised.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he should be.
Go and buy the book, people. It's a good read.
She'd be happy with that, shouldn't he? And it's weird because although it only seems like a few seconds ago that we finished the interview, in the time between then and now, I've finished reading the book.
What?
And, it does take quite a dark turn, doesn't it, halfway through? So there's a reason to buy it without going into any spoilers. It's, there's a plot twist. Yeah,
that's a genuine recommendation, that one.
There's a Christmas type sort of thing.
Or any other time of year, treat yourself.
But what have we got coming up next?
Well, what have
chaps?
We got coming up?
Because we don't
up?
Rest on our laurels, do we?
No.
No, because we haven't got any.
No, exactly, yeah.
You don't have any laurels. You have to win something to get laurels, don't you?
I think you do, yeah.
But next week is a really different episode, isn't it?
It is. It is a bit of a curveball. We did our first ever podcast in front of a live audience.
Yes.
Part of the Ilkley Literature Festival Fringe. And we managed to avoid the rain as well, which was pretty incredible.
Yeah, we managed to avoid the rain because we were under a gazebo. I mean, the audience got quite wet.
Yeah. I was quite comfy.
You were fine.
Well, they have to look after the talent, don't they?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's worth tuning in next week because we came up with something quite spectacular, I think, between the three of us and the audience.
Our promise was to deliver the greatest story ever written. And I think we got pretty blumming close to that.
Yeah, close enough.
Yeah.
To avoid any sort of trade descriptions.
Well, probably not in that sense. But, I mean, it was... you know, it turned out well, didn't it? It was good fun.
I think so. I think that's probably the best way of describing it. We can say that we really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Obviously, we can't speak for the audience.
No, we can't speak for the
audience.
They might
have had an entirely different experience.
Listening next week, but the main thing is that we enjoyed it.
We had a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And no one left. No one left halfway through. That's a good sign, eh?
Because I thought about it.
Yeah. In many ways, though, it's like cows, isn't it? If they know the rain's coming, they all sat down and then didn't want to get up because otherwise it would all get really wet.
What are you saying about our lovely audience?
They're in tune with the weather.
Yeah, so we told a story using suggestions from the audience and we basically blagged our way through, how would you describe it? It was a tale of love, loss.
And lighthouses.
Yes.
And lighthouses, there you go. Yeah. And macabre water sports as well.
I think that's fair to say. Yeah, without giving too much away.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think anyone is going to piece together from that description what actually happened, are they? So
probably not. Yeah, it was a real feast for the senses. Yeah.
So make sure you listen next week, people, for something a bit different.
Yes.
Do it. And don't forget, if you want to talk to us, if you want to make any suggestions or you just want to say hello, whatever, get in touch on Twitter, @failingwriters. Or you can email us, Bairdie, where can they email us?
failingwriterspodcast@gmail.com. Or you could just like and subscribe to this podcast, which is what podcasters are supposed to ask people to do, isn't it?
So yes, we should say, subscribe and things.
Yeah.
And send the reviewers.
Yeah.
And tell all your friends. Do tell your friends,
yeah.
Yeah,
that
do.
That does actually help.
Yeah.
And
really
hey, who knows, we might even, if you say something nice about us, we might send you some of our new merch, what we've got.
Yes.
It's less exciting if you say it out loud, but if we leave it like that, we've got some cool merch.
Yeah.
That does make it sound pretty cool.
Yeah. If you want some, get in touch.
Yeah.
And if there's a literary festival going on near you that needs an act for it, let us know.
Yeah, we're well up for another one.
Absolutely. Yeah. It really was fun.
It was good fun.
Really good. Really good. As you'll find out next week. Do listen.
Until then.
Take care. Keep writing if that's your thing.
Yeah, do keep writing, people. We need to do some writing as well.
We will be quickly asking that question before next week. We've been a bit distracted, haven't we, by the whole...
You've been warned, chap. You have been warned. See you later.
Cheers.
Bye.
Hello.
Hello.
Where's everybody gone?